Good afternoon and welcome to the 381st meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Hedges Hall at Point Lookout in Northport, Maine. And a particular welcome to our public radio audience reaching us through the good offices of the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, MPBN. I'm Tom DeMarco, filling in for our president, Mac DeFord. Founded in 1983, the forum is now into its 32nd year of bringing you on a monthly basis informed speakers on all aspects of foreign affairs and U.S. diplomatic policy. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. The forum is very pleased today to bring you Senator Angus King. It would be folly of me to introduce Senator King to this audience who know him well, but I will tell you an anecdote. It takes place in November, just prior to November of 2012, at the senatorial debate, which was held at the Camden Opera House. You remember that? Mac DeFord was the moderator. I think a lot of you were there. The question that came to the senator then, we were calling him governor at that point, was about drug policy. And he said that he was against legalization of marijuana, and he very briefly said why it was. But then he said, but I have a story to tell you that goes completely against my position, but it's a great story. And the story was a friend of his who's a chief of police had told him that when they go in on a domestic disturbance call and they suspect alcohol is part of the problem, they go in with their hands on their holsters. But if they smell marijuana, everybody just relaxes. Well, I thought in this day and age of political debates, you don't hear many moments like that. What you hear are people who use every single question as an excuse to get as quickly as possible to the memorized talking points. It's a pleasure to have as our senator someone who doesn't profess total certainty on anything, but is willing to call a complex issue complex when it is. That's what makes him Angus King. Ladies and gentlemen, our senator.
Thanks, Tom. Thank you. Thank you. It's wonderful to be at the monthly meeting of the CIA and State Department Alumni Association. I want to talk today about an aspect of foreign policy. And by the way, I have to begin by saying Congress did something last night. We passed a five-year highway bill, the first time since 2007, bipartisan basis, both houses. It's got some not so great parts, but it also has some very good parts, including, much to everyone's surprise, the reauthorization of the Export-Import Bank is buried in the highway bill. A five-year bill with modest increases, and I just have to share that because the conventional wisdom is we never get anything done. And in fact, occasionally, we do manage to get something done, and this was one of those moments. It happened. It happened on Thursday night at about 9 o'clock. Major legislation. It's a little known provision of the Constitution that budgets and major controversial legislation only happen in the middle of the night. They're just. I don't know why that is, but it was certainly the case with budgets when I was in Augusta. We're going to talk about the Arctic a bit, but. Before that, we got to talk about climate change for just briefly, and it's certainly appropriate given what's going on in Paris. Why is Paris important? Paris is important because this is a global problem. I cannot come back to Maine and say, you should pay a carbon tax and add to the price of gasoline when China is building two coal plants a month. It doesn't pass the straight face test in terms of either political or public policy solutions. This has to be handled on a global basis. Now, that's why Paris is so important, but also why is it important for us, the counter of what I just said is, why is it so important for us to do things if indeed it has to happen also in China and India and other parts of the world? The answer is leadership and credibility. We can't go to Paris or go to any international conference and say, we want you to control your carbon emissions if we're just willy-nilly going forward with our economy, no questions asked. We have 5% of the world's population and we use 25% of the world's energy. We can't lecture, given where we are in the world, we can't go to India and say, sorry, you can't air condition. Or go to China and say, sorry, but you can't have second cars. Second children, maybe, no second cars. So we have to understand that this is a global problem, and we have to be committed to it too. And the commitment has to be real and meaningful. That's one of the reasons that I'm such a strong proponent of the president's clean power plan, because it's a real step in dealing with this issue from our point of view in this country, and it also, importantly, gives us credibility in order to be able to work with the countries where we have to be able to have some relationship, that they will take on this challenge as well. Okay, you all know the challenge. I don't have to go into it in any great detail. I carry around with me I've got it in all of my suits. By the way, I've got a whole bunch of pinstripe suits. My office people think I only have one, but it's actually different suits. But they look the same. But anyway, in all of my pockets, I carry this little card. And I hand it to people, particularly my colleagues who don't believe anything is happening. And the card, the title of the card is Climate Change in a Nutshell. And it's all you really need to know about climate change. And Tom will be glad to leave several of these with you. And it's on the website. You can put it on your website. But here's the two sides of the card. One side is 1 million years of data on CO2 in the atmosphere. And what you can see is that there's a lot of variation between about 180 and 280 parts per million over the past 1 million years. So what people say, well, it always varies, you know? Of course it varies. Yeah, it did. It did. That's the range, 180 to 280. But then you get over here to 1860, roughly, when we started burning fossil fuels in a big way, and the number just, the line goes like this. And we're now, this upper corner is 400 parts per million, and the last time we were at that level was 3 million years ago. And by the way, the oceans were 60 feet higher than they are today. So this chart, it seems to me, answers two of the three questions about climate change. One is something happening? Yes. The second question is, do people have anything to do with it? Well, unless it's the greatest coincidence in the history of the planet, yes. Because the acceleration starts at the very moment that we started to load the atmosphere with CO2. So that answers two of the three questions. The third question is, so what? CO2's in the air, we breathe it, you can't smell it, it doesn't poison you. Well, it does poison you if you're in a closed garage with a car running, but other than that, it's something that's part of our atmosphere. So what? That's what the other side of the card is about. The other side of the card is 1 million years. I got in debate about this with one of my colleagues in a committee, and he said, well, you know, the climate's roughly changed, you know, in 100 years, it's changed. I pulled my card out and I said, I'll see your 100 and raise it 1 million. But this is the relationship between temperature and CO2. It's almost an exact correlation. CO2 in the atmosphere goes down, temperature goes down. CO2 in the atmosphere goes up, temperature goes up. You just look at it, the two lines, blue and red, follow each other almost exactly. And of course, we're now at this point where we're really off the chart in terms of where we've been for about the past 1 million years. So that's the sort of big picture about why we have to do something about this and why we have to pay attention to it. And in Maine, this is real. This isn't an academic question. If you talk to the lobstermen, they'll tell you that the center of gravity of lobstering 30 years ago was in Casco Bay. The center of gravity in lobstering now is up towards Stonington. We're having great harvests everywhere. The lobsters, there are plenty of them, way more than there were 25 or 30 years ago. That's a separate issue we think maybe has something to do with the decline of the cod, which eat baby lobsters. But in any case, but the center of gravity of the industry is moving north and east. There is now virtually no lobster industry in Rhode Island and Massachusetts. It's just gone. Another thing that we're becoming concerned about that frankly wasn't on people's screen over the last 3 or 4 years is that all of this CO2 in the atmosphere is being absorbed into the ocean and is turning the ocean acidic. It's a chemical reaction, and the ocean, acidic nature of the ocean is rising, which makes it hard for shellfish to form shells. We're seeing situations where you have a bucket of clams, and their shells are so soft they collapse. That is a potential disaster for Maine. And so this is not something where, oh, well, it's just happening somewhere else. It's happening here. This is a significant challenge for our state. It's also things are happening in the trees, the nature of trees, the nature of insects. Lyme disease is moving further north than it ever has before. There are all kinds of practical, real-life effects of this that we have to be cognizant of. What about the Arctic? I didn't have time to hook my phone up to the computer, but I would urge you to Google NOAA, N-O-A-A, NOAA Arctic Ice. Okay, NOAA Arctic Ice. Go to YouTube. By the way, I don't know about you, but I feel pretty cool that I was around at the time of the invention of a new verb. To Google. Can you imagine telling your grandchildren, I was there when they invented run? You know? Well, yes, pretty close. Anyway, go to YouTube, NOAA Arctic Ice, and what you see is an animation. It takes about a minute. It's the extent of Arctic ice every year since 1987. And you can, it goes very fast, and you can see it. And what you see is this amazing contraction. It's dramatic of the amount of ice in the Arctic. Now, 2012 was the lowest year. It came back a little bit in 13 and 14, but the trend is really obvious in terms of the size of the ice sheet in the Arctic. And that brings us to the Arctic and what I want to really talk about a bit today. The Arctic ice is decreasing rather dramatically, and that creates a whole new set of challenges, international relations challenges, scientific challenges that we are now facing. Why? Well, think of it like this. The diminution of the Arctic ice is as if we are discovering the Mediterranean Sea. It's an entirely new body of water that essentially has been locked up and unusable and invisible for as long as human beings have been on the earth. All of a sudden, it's this whole new ocean. And of course, like all most large bodies of water, it's bordered by a bunch of countries. Russia, Canada, the United States, the Scandinavian countries, Greenland. It has a great international aspect to it. So the question is, what are the implications of the reduction of the Arctic ice, which everyone expects to continue? Perhaps accelerate, we don't know, but even on rather conservative estimates will be not ice-free, but navigable in a serious way in about 20 years, 15 to 20 years. There are ships going through now, commercial ships. I think last summer there were 70 or 80. The summer before there were over 100. And I said, when I saw those figures, I said, why is it declining? I thought, well, the ice has come back. No, the Russians are charging more for the icebreakers to get ships through. So the economic advantage isn't as great. It's a, a 10 to 20 day shorter trip from Asia to Europe or the east coast of the US over the Arctic than it is through the Panama Canal. So it's a significant reduction in shipping time and shipping costs. And why am I here? Why does a senator from Maine care about all of this? Guess where the first ports are on the east coast of the United States after you come through the Arctic? Eastport, Searsport, and Portland. Enormous opportunity throughout history. Countries and cities have succeeded that are port cities, that are the centers of commerce. Singapore is a place where it has no natural resources, but it's the most vital place, one of the most vital places in the world, and it's built itself as a port, as a center of commerce, as a crossing area. So Maine has some significant opportunity here, which is already manifesting itself. If you go down to Portland and look on the Commercial Street, down beyond DeMillo's, you'll see a big outfit and these big containers with the word IMSKIP, E-I-M-S-K-I-P. It's an Icelandic shipping company that has made Portland its U.S. headquarters. And it has opened up links for us with Iceland, but also with what I love the term the High North, the Scandinavian countries. A product can come in from Europe, come into Portland, go on the train. The state has now, quite wisely, I think, made a rail link right to the container so they can go from the ship to the rail link and down the East Coast very efficiently. And so this is the first little opening of the door to the trade opportunities that I think will only expand in future years. Lots of opportunity for Maine, and we're starting to already see that. I went to Iceland in October. If any of you have not been to Iceland, I suspect not many of you have. You should. It's a neat place. It's 4.5 hours from Boston, flight, and it's a very interesting place. It's heated entirely by geothermal. There are big pipes that come out of the ground and heat every building on the island virtually by the heat that's in the ground. Makes me a little nervous that the whole place is a volcano, but okay. Most of their electricity is from geothermal sources. So very interesting place, very strategically located right sort of in the middle of the North Atlantic, and wonderful people. Descendants of the Vikings, a very, very interesting people. But anyway, they have this big annual conference on the Arctic, and I went up there. But also, I wanted to see, okay, what's going on here that we can use, and what ideas can we steal for Maine? And one of the most interesting was a thing called, they call it the Ocean Cluster House, and it's a big old warehouse. And it's got 30 or 40 businesses, all related to oceans. And what they're doing is figuring out how to get more value out of the ocean products. They've now gotten to the point where I think the figure is 30 times the value from a codfish than it used to be when they just caught the fish and ate it. There was even, if you can believe this, a really high-end women's shirt made of cod skin. I don't think Mary wants one, but they were, and they were actually, one of the companies was working on how to make important products from ground up lobster shells. This is the old thing of we're going to get all the value from the pig except the squeal, where they're using all of the what were used to be called byproducts for pharmaceuticals and cosmetics and all of these uses that are much more value. When I first ran for governor in 1994, I said, no fish should ever leave Maine with its head on. The Wall Street Journal characterized that as the most bizarre campaign promise in the history of American politics. They didn't get it. What I was talking about was value added. We need to be adding value to products, not sending out raw logs or whole fish. We need to be doing the processing and adding the value. That's what creates and keeps the jobs here. In any case, that's what the Ocean Cluster House is working on. And indeed, we're now starting, the guy who started the one in Iceland is working with people in Maine to start a very similar Ocean Cluster House in Portland as part of the oceanfront development. Okay, what do we do about the Arctic? What should be our role? A number of things. Number one, America has a lead in this, not only because of our capacity, but because for right now we are the chair for the next 2 years of something called the Arctic Council, which is like a mini UN for the Arctic. And it involves the countries that are the bordering states to the Arctic, Russia, Canada, the U.S., Scandinavian countries, and the native people, the First Nation people in northern Canada and Finland, Lapland, those areas. Interestingly, this tells you what's sort of happening and that it's maybe something we should pay attention to. This year at the Arctic Council, China and Singapore asked to be observer members. That tells you that, you know, there's something going on here that is worth attending to. So we have a leadership role in the Arctic Council. Lisa Murkowski and I, who is my colleague from Alaska in the Senate, went up to a town in Baffin Bay with Secretary Kerry at the meeting where the U.S. took over the leadership of the council. By the way, I got interested in this subject a couple of years ago, and I went up to Lisa Murkowski on the floor of the Senate and said, I want to be the Arctic senator. Without any hesitation at all, she said, you can be the assistant Arctic senator. Because she's very engaged in this issue too, and I just saw her yesterday, and we've started the Arctic Caucus, and we have 8 or 10 senators who are interested in this, some from Arizona and other places, but who are taking an interest in this subject. Okay, American leadership is important, and I want to be sure I don't miss some of the things that we want to talk about. Infrastructure is important. An icebreaker is the road builder of the Arctic. The Russians, at this meeting in Reykjavik, the Russians were there, and they had a slide. They have 17 heavy icebreakers, nuclear and diesel electric. We have 1.5. They say half, we have 2, but the other one is used mostly for spare parts for the one that we have. That's pitiful. That's just unacceptable. And you know, Finland has more icebreakers than we do. And yet Alaska has a big swath of frontage on the Arctic. So if a ship wants to go through the Northern Passage, which is the easiest passage, they got to pay the Russians something like $400,000 to lead them through. You know, I'm not in this for the money, but we need to have the icebreaker capacity. Now, the president went to Alaska last summer. It was the first time a U.S. president's been above the Arctic Circle, I believe, and uttered the word icebreaker, which was good. But this has to be part of national policy. They're expensive, probably $1 billion apiece. But if this is going to be this expanded opportunity and area, it's like saying, well, we want to develop Maine, but we're not going to build any roads. You know, but we absolutely have to do that. So infrastructure has to be part of what we do, and the infrastructure in this case is all about icebreakers. The next thing that we have to do, and those of you who are interested in foreign policy certainly understand this, we need to accede to the UN Law of the Sea Treaty. The Law of the Sea Treaty, I don't know how many countries are part of it, 180 or 170. Most of the countries around the world, we aren't. And what that means is that we're on the sidelines of the process of establishing ownership and sovereignty over areas of these uncharted waters. In other words, there's a process in the Law of the Sea Treaty whereby you stake your claim, in effect, and it's adjudicated through the process of the treaty. We're not in the game. Russia's already claiming a lot of territory because of the, where the continental shelf is in the Arctic, and we're just, you know, standing back, which strikes me as bizarre. Why haven't we approved it? Because there's an attitude in the Senate among some people that any treaty is an abrogation of U.S. sovereignty. My view is that treaties actually enhance sovereignty if they give you rights and opportunities to extend the power isn't really the word I want, but the influence of this country, and we're losing that. I had a professor in college who talked about governmental philosophy. Gove 5 was the name of the course. Vincent Starzinger. And Starzinger used to say in Gove 5, the questions on the exams change every year, but the answers stay the same. But he had a brilliant insight that I think applies in this case. He said, a stoplight is an infringement on your personal sovereignty. It's an infringement on your freedom to drive wherever you want. But by obeying stoplights, you're given the freedom to drive without risk of being killed. It's an interesting concept that you gain something by giving up something. And what you gain is greater than what you give up. And I think this applies to the law of the sea. I don't want to give away U.S. sovereignty, but I do want to have the opportunity to protect, for example, littoral rights as the Arctic gets developed. So that's something that we ought to do. I don't know if it's going to be done in this atmosphere in Washington, because there's this mood that any treaty... We didn't even approve the disability treaty a couple of years ago. Any treaty is somehow an abrogation of sovereignty. I'm sort of puzzled by that, because it puts us on the sideline, and clearly I think prejudices the interests of the country. The next thing that we have to do, I think, is help to prioritize research. I was asked to speak in Washington a couple of months ago to a scientific gathering about the Arctic, and instead of making a speech, I said, here are 10 questions we need answered. There's a lot of scientific data that we don't have. For example, we don't know what the bottom looks like. We don't, you know, you have charts of Penobscot Bay, you know where all the rocks are. We don't know that in the Arctic. We don't have basic geologic and geographic data. We don't know what the special risks are for drilling. Now, Shell has pulled out. The president has suspended drilling in the Arctic, but that could change, A, with another president, B, with a different price of oil. And we need to understand the science of offshore drilling in the Arctic as opposed to the Gulf of Mexico, and are there special challenges? We just need answers to those questions. We need to understand the implications of the Arctic ice melting, how fast it's melting, what's happening to that fresh water, what are the implications. One of the biggest issues of climate change for me is the potential melting of the Greenland ice sheet. And I would commend to you an article that was in the New York Times, I think the New York Times Magazine, about 2 weeks ago on the glaciers, about Greenland and Antarctica. This is where the real danger is to me, in two ways. One, if the ice sheets melt, and the question is not are they melting, the question is how fast. But there is something like 60 feet of sea level locked up in the ice sheets. And that if they melt more rapidly than is expected, it could be anywhere from 3 feet to 6 feet to 10 feet. About a meter is expected over the next in this century, but it could be two or three times that amount. Nobody really knows. We need the science on how fast is it melting? What is there any way to slow it down? And is it going to be catastrophic or merely annoying. And we need to understand that, and that's really a scientific question. The other issue with regard to the melting of the Greenland ice sheet is its effect on ocean currents. And that's a very serious and tough scientific challenge. As fresh water goes in the North Atlantic and the water is colder, does it fall to the bottom? Does that change the salinity, the thermocline, and does that affect ocean currents? A significant effect on the Gulf Stream would render the British Isles and Northern Europe uninhabitable. We all think of England as to the east. You know what's to the east? Marseille, France. The French Riviera is on our almost exact latitude, mid-Italy. Britain is east of Hudson's Bay. The only reason it's a habitable region of the world is the Gulf Stream. If you go to Southern Ireland, I was amazed to go to Southern Ireland, there are palm trees on the coast of Southern Ireland because of the warm water that's brought up through the Western Atlantic and then across and up by the British Isles and to Scandinavia. If the Gulf Stream is shifted in some way, in a significant way, the results will be not minor at all. They could be absolutely dramatic because that's what allows those places to be for human habitation. We need a gap analysis. We need the scientists to tell us what we don't know and then go from there. So scientific exploration, we need just to recap. I always follow the Southern Preacher Rule. Do you know the Southern Preacher Rule of public speaking? Tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you told them. So we're in the middle part. But so we need to exercise our leadership, infrastructure, the Law of the Sea Treaty, scientific research, and we've got to do all this through multilateral organizations, whether it's the UN or the Arctic Council. Because if you think about again my example of the Mediterranean, a lot of wars happened in order to settle the borders and the relationships in the Mediterranean. We'd like to avoid that if we can. And one way to avoid that is to work through international organizations so that we are doing this in a rational and peaceful way rather than through confrontation and conflict. The Russians are already developing significant military assets along the Arctic. Significant. Ships, bases, air bases, they are poised. I wouldn't, as an overstatement to say they are poised to militarize the Arctic, but they are making significant investments. We also have assets up there. My first trip to the Arctic was on a U.S. Virginia class attack nuclear submarine under the ice. I went up with two or three other folks from Washington, and it was pretty cool. We went into Prudhoe Bay and then flew in a small plane out over the ice 200 or 300 miles. The landing strip on the ice was denominated by black garbage bags. You could see the garbage bags, and we landed on the ice and went to this experimental, every year they have a program called ICEX, went and visited to see the science they were doing, and then the USS New Mexico comes crashing up through the ice. It was cool. We got on the submarine. The chief of the naval operations, John Greenert, was with us. Tom Friedman was with us on the trip, and spent a day and a night on the submarine. So we have these assets up there, and it was quite an experience. The most moving part of the trip for me was after dinner. We're 450 feet under the ice. And by the way, driving a submarine in the Arctic is tricky because you not only have to worry about the bottom, you have to worry about the top. Very sophisticated sonars, you can imagine. Anyway, there were five sailors on the ship, three of whom were from Maine, which was really cool to meet those guys. But there were five sailors who were re-enlisting their time was up, so it was time for them to take the oath and reenlist. So under the ice at 9 o'clock at night, the chief of naval operations swore in these sailors to the Navy. It was a very powerful experience, and the young men who were on that ship were extraordinary. They took such pride in what they were doing. So we have assets up there as well, but the Russians are moving aggressively in that area, and therefore the importance of multilateral international cooperation, I think, is very important. The final piece is what I mentioned, the Arctic Caucus, the fact that Congress has to take an interest in this. We have to support it through funds for icebreakers, through support for acceding to the Law of the Sea Convention, providing support for scientific research. All of those things involve the Congress and the administration. So I think this is an enormously important part of the future of our international relations. Of course, it's only one other piece, but one of the realities, it seems to me, of current international relations is what I call compartmentalization. The idea that you can have conflict with somebody over here, hypothetically, let's call it Ukraine, but you can have cooperation over here, Syria, maybe, the Arctic. And that is, I think, that's the way we have to think, that there are different interests and different points of view, but we have to cooperate where we can. And occasionally my friends say, well, we can't work with the Russians. And my response is, did you ever hear of Stalin? Very bad guy. Very strong ally in World War II. Why? Because we had a common interest of defeating Hitler. If we can find areas of common interest, and all of you know more about foreign policy than I do, but to me, the essence of foreign policy is that countries do what's in their interest in the end. And so if we can find areas where our interests align, and I think the Arctic may be one of them, I think in the long run, it will be beneficial to all the countries involved and certainly all the citizens of the country. So the Arctic is important. It's part of this larger issue of climate change. It has importance to the United States, but it also is important to Maine. Thank you very much. Tom's going to take. We've got a whole passel of them. That's the retired CIA table right over there. Questions, Tom? Tom and I go back to pop tech days together.
You weren't going to get out of here without a question about polar bears. You mentioned the verb to Google. If you're really good at Googling, you can get it to tell you how common a given search is. And there are more searches on polar bears than any other species except humans. Are you, the assistant Arctic secretary, willing to be the chief polar bear secretary?
Well, I do live in Brunswick, where there are a lot of polar bears.
It is a problem. Does that figure at all? Children in this country are terribly distressed about what's happening to the polar bears. So.
Well, I mean, that's one part of the reality, which I didn't really discuss. I talked about it in terms of Maine and things like lobster, but we're seeing enormous changes in habitat. And that's going to affect seals, polar bears, and people. The native people that live along the shore are seeing, their villages are sometimes literally disappearing. But I think polar bears, we refer to polar bears? Charismatic megafauna. That's a large animal that's really cute. But certainly polar bears and the habitat of polar bears, I mean, it would be absolutely tragic to see their habitat progressively reduced.
It was good to hear you talk about icebreakers. I have the sense that for politicians, icebreakers are cocktail parties more than. How can an icebreaker cost $1 billion? Do they cost other countries that much, or is this the military-industrial complex at work?
That's a good question. Of course, that was a rough number, but it's a large and very complex ship. To give you a point of reference, one of the destroyers at Bath Iron Works are about $1.6 billion, but that's principally because of the internals, the complexity of the radar and the weapon system. But a major ship is a very expensive proposition, particularly one that has to be specially designed and built for this challenging.
Is BIW up to this? Are they?
Could they might be able to. They could certainly build them in terms of the size. I think it would be an opportunity for us.
Can you talk on our conflict with Canada over a right to passage? Is there a conflict with Canada over a right to passage?
I don't know.
Yeah. You know, there's this notion of a 200-mile zone of sovereignty. And as you look at the Northwest Passage, virtually all of it is within ours or Canada's 200-mile exclusion zone, all except the Bering Sea, in which we're as close to the sea as Russia is. Don't we have sufficient sovereignty to control the Northwest Passage?
Well, there are several routes through the Arctic now, and the most open one and the easiest is the one that goes right along the Russian shore, the so-called northern route. And that's where most of the ships are going now. Now, as the ice disappears, it will be somewhat more easier to use the Northwest Passage. By the way, I think one of the most important bodies of water or places in the world is going to be the Bering Strait, which is very, you can see it right up there, it's very narrow. And that's where a huge amount of the world's trade is going to take place.
We had a broadcast of Diane Rehm's show earlier this week about the Paris climate talks. And to listen to that, I listened to it from beginning to end, you would think the whole notion of climate change denial had gone away. They never addressed whether climate change is real or not. And yet I have a hunch it hasn't gone away in the Senate.
It will when they all get a copy of my card. I gave one yesterday to a member of Congress.
By the way, I will.
Let me comment on that because it's interesting. I was at a meeting yesterday of something called the Climate Change, no, Wednesday at lunch, the Climate Change Task Force, which is a group that, unfortunately, now is only Democrats plus B. But we were talking about this, and there's a sense, and this is only a sense, this is impressionistic, that the edifice of denial is crumbling. Just in the last 6 months, you hear less of the aggressive, it's not happening, forget it. And finally, we're getting to a place where we're starting to talk about, okay, what do we do about it? I don't want to overstate that and say, you know, it's everybody's linking arms in Paris, but I do think there's a higher level of acceptance that indeed something is going on that we need to deal with.
Could you address the topic of coastal Maine's danger because of rising sea level? Aren't we particularly prone to that?
Yes and no. And the yes part is, of course, we're a coastal state. We have the longest coastline of any state in the country. I'll share with you a great word. You can use this anywhere. You know, you can amaze your friends. Crenellated. Crenellated. A crenel is the top of a castle. You know how they go like this? Our coast is crenellated. It's so crooked. That's what, if it were straight like California's, it would be 3,500 miles long. So yes, of course we're vulnerable because of the coast that we have. On the other hand, most of our coast is rock. In areas of Florida, for example, where the coastline is more sand and earth, that's where that's even more vulnerable because of the danger of erosion. The rocks along the main coast aren't going to erode anytime soon, but clearly a sea level rise will change. I was on the ocean recently and learned a life lesson. I'll share with you. The waves were coming in, hitting the rocks. Anywhere you go, you know, go down 500 yards from here. The waves come in, hit the rocks. Waves come in, hit the rocks. The rocks are very hard. Very hard. The waves are very soft. But you know what? In the end, the waves are going to win. And there's a lesson there about perseverance. Now, the waves are going to persevere over a couple of million years. We only have a few years to persevere, but perseverance is an important quality. That's a bonus for you today.
Scientists have led the charge in informing decision makers about CO2 and Arctic effects. To what degree are you helping support science to keep the dialogue going?
Well, I think one of the most important functions of the federal government is supporting scientific research. National Science Foundation, I met just Wednesday with a woman named Ellen Williams, who's the head of an organization called ARPA-E, which is the energy research part of the Department of Energy. It's an incredibly important function that we can perform to support basic research, and it's something that I'm a big proponent.
How is the change in U.S.-Russian relations impacted policy on the Arctic? Are we talking enough to the Russians? Are they willing to talk to us?
That's a good question, and I think the answer is the jury is sort of still out. For example, I mentioned that Lisa Murkowski and I went up to this meeting in Iqaluit, I think it's called, on Baffin Island with Secretary Kerry. This was a ministerial meeting. It was at the Secretary of State level. Lavrov wasn't there. Now, this was in the middle of the Ukraine unpleasantness, and that may have been part of it. So I can't really answer the degree to which the Russians are prepared to engage. I can tell you that they had a big delegation in Iceland, and they were on the stage, had slides, had a big presentation. So they certainly are engaged to some extent, but I thought it was interesting that Lavrov wasn't at the Arctic
sign.
Council conference.
Yeah. The question is, why has climate change, like gun control, become such an ideologically driven partisan issue? Well, is it? You're saying why, but is it still?
I find that a really puzzling question, and I've asked myself, I made a speech in the Senate and said, I don't understand why this is a partisan issue. When I came of age in Maine politics, the giants of the environmental protection in Augusta were all Republicans. David Huber, Hadi Hildreth, Harry Richardson, those were the people that created the DEP and created the Coastal Conveyance Law and all of those things. They were all Republicans. Teddy Roosevelt invented the conservation movement in this country. So I just can't understand how this became a partisan issue, except maybe that Al Gore invented it. I don't know. And to me, what's puzzling about it is what we're talking about here is science. You know, it's like, you know, light goes 186,000 miles a second. No, it doesn't. Wait a minute. It does. You know, pi is 3.1416. I mean, this is science. This isn't, we can argue, to me, it's logical to argue about what's the answer. You know, what should we have a carbon tax? Should we subsidize solar? You know, those are policy questions. But should we... If that's your broker, tell him to buy low, sell high. I can see arguing about the policy questions, but I don't understand arguing about what is essentially data. So, I've puzzled about that, but somehow that's where we are. But I think it's starting to change.
You know, people, handwriting really matters here. But and this is a wonderful question that I can't read the end of, but you have to imagine what the end is going to be. Senator King, I have worked in the Arctic and Antarctica for WSF and WSGS. These areas should be used for research only. They are just a canary in the coal mine, not an area to be exploited. These seas aren't easy to navigate and prone to maritime casualties. We need to sign a treaty, and I can't read the rest. Could you comment on that?
Well, I can understand that, and I certainly agree that and scientific research is a part of it. But human beings, being what they are, if it's 20 days shorter to sail from China to New York through the Northern Passage than it is through the Panama Canal, people are going to do it. I mean, we can't wish that away. And if there's 20 years of oil up there, somebody's going to drill for it. We may say, we're not going to, but the Russians might, or the Canadians might, or the Finns might. And so that means we have to think about how to establish some common relationships to govern it responsibly and to be stewards of it. We can't just say, well, we're not going to get involved and therefore we don't have to worry about this. I think because it's a multinational situation, we have to be realistic.
Does Canada have a strong... You haven't talked much about Canada. I mean, they clearly have got to be very involved. Does Canada have a strong presence in, for instance, in the Arctic area? Are they on the Arctic Council?
Oh, yes.
Are they as strong as the Russians?
They were the chairs before we took over last spring. By the way, I don't know if you all are aware of the definition of a Canadian. A Canadian is an unarmed North American with health insurance. so you know. They're very much engaged in this. Well, when Harry Reid asked me what committees I was going to be on, I said I'd like to be involved with foreign policy because I can see Canada from Maine.
It went over better for you than it did for Sarah. Well, I am deluged with questions about what it is like to work at a dysfunctional Senate, but was being on a submarine cool enough to offset the frustrations of being in the Senate in today's political atmosphere? And while we're at it, last night, the Senate also voted to take away essential services in Obamacare. What will it take for the Senate to focus on things that matter, violence, racial inequality, our role in the world?
Yeah, that's right. The two things that the Senate did last night was pass the highway bill, but also repeal the Affordable Care Act for something like the 50th time. And there was, what else? It was the Affordable Care Act? And Planned Parenthood, and defund Planned Parenthood. Neither of those are going to happen. The president's going to veto that bill, and it was all a show. I mean, it was all, look what we're doing. And the president's going to veto it. The veto's going to be sustained, and we'll move on. The difference is he's going to sign the highway bill. I find it both frustrating and exhilarating at the same time, if that makes any sense. It's frustrating for obvious reasons, because it's very hard to get things done. The framers, by the way, wanted it to be hard to get things done. They designed
did they want it
the
to be this hard?
Huh?
Did they want
well,
it to
that's
be this
question,
hard?
This hard. They wanted it to be cumbersome and slow because they didn't want a rush to, you know, didn't want it to be easy for the majority to override the minority and just, you know, do things in the heat of passion. They succeeded beyond their wildest expectations, however. And it is frustrating, but I have to tell you, I had dinner Wednesday night with one of my best friends in the Senate, Lamar Alexander, a Republican senator from Tennessee. He's just a outstanding legislator, a model public servant. And we were talking about this, and he pulled out of his pocket, and it's in my other suit in Washington, a list of things that we've done this year that you don't hear about because all that gets attention is the negative stuff. You know, we passed a major rewrite of the Veterans Administration law. We passed a complete rewrite of the Federal Job Training Act. We now have a bipartisan budget deal. We just did the highway bill. He is the chair of the committee on education. We're on the verge, I hope next week, of passing the first rewrite of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act in something like 9 years. So all of that is happening, but it doesn't get any publicity. I once said, if I got up one morning and walked across the Kennebec River, the headline would be King Unable to Swim. You know, legislature critical. And it's sort of in the nature of our of the way the society works is that the conflict is what gets the attention, not successes. So things are getting done. And I'm an optimistic person. You know, if little I didn't go there expecting that everything was going to be easy. So when we have little victories like reauthorizing the Export-Import Bank, I think that's a step forward. But it is it's quite an experience. But I think there's a little bit of a thaw. The other thing I should say that's very important, because I hear this a lot, it's absolutely true that the place is highly partisan institutionally. You know, you have the caucuses and you have the caucus lunches and all that. But personally, it's not. There are relationships. I have people say, it's really a shame you're at this place where everybody hates everybody else. That's not true. And I find that reassuring. My favorite hour of the week down there is the Wednesday morning prayer breakfast. And the reason I like it is, A, it's the only meeting of the week that's bipartisan. It's the only time that you have Republicans and Democrats in the same room, other than official committee meetings, on a kind of informal basis. And two, you get to learn about your colleagues. And one of the interesting things that I found reassuring is senators are ordinary people. This table could be a group of senators and they'd be indistinguishable from the people who are down there. They're middle class people. Many of them come from very poor backgrounds. Orrin Hatch was raised in a house with dirt floors and no indoor plumbing. Harry Reid was raised in a house with no indoor plumbing. There's a pattern there. But I find that reassuring. These are not aristocrats. These aren't, Rockefeller, Jay Rockefeller, okay. But by and large, Lindsey Graham was born above a barroom and pool hall that his parents ran. They both died when he was a teenager and he raised his sister. I mean, these are real people. They have different views of how the world should work. They're definitely differences, but I find that reassuring. So I'm a perennial optimist, Tom. So I find a positive.
Angus, is it possible they are real people to you because you are not of the opposition party, because of your position as an independent? Are they real people to members of the other parties?
I think there's a little of that. I'm sort of a curiosity, I think. And maybe there's a little of that, but really, a lot of it is about personalities. I mean, the reason we got this education bill is that Lamar Alexander and Patty Murray could work together. Patty Murray's a Democratic senator from the state of Washington. She's the ranking member on that committee. He's the chair, and they work together, and they worked it out. And they use the 80-20 rule. 80% we agree on, let's do that. 20% we don't agree on, let's put that aside. And they got a bill. It came out of the committee 22-0. And it passed the Senate, 90-3 or something. So I don't want to sugarcoat it. I mean, it's a problem. It's definitely not the most functional place in the world. There are lots of reasons for that. Money and politics is one of them. The whole 30-second ad culture that we're in, campaigning all the time. Let me put the money thing in perspective for you. The average U.S. senator, Maine's a smaller state, but if you're from an average state, you've got to raise $6,000 a day, every day, 365 days a year, for 6 years, to have enough money to run for re-election. Think of that for a minute. You very quickly run out of friends and family. And this is a problem in our politics, and compounding that is something that I don't think the general public is fully aware of, and that is the dramatic change that Citizens United and the super PACs and the dark money has made. It used to be that you raised your money and your opponent raised his or her money and you duped it out. Now it's like, remember the Trojan War, the image of the Trojan War where you had Hector and Achilles fighting on the plains, but the gods were up here also fighting? That's what it's like. Because, for example, in my election, My opponent, Mr. Summers, my Republican opponent, I think he raised maybe $1 million. I think it was maybe less. But he had over $6 or $7 million spent on his behalf by outside groups who we didn't know who they were. And it's quite conceivable that when I run in 3 years, somebody could come in and spend $20 million, one person, or two or three people, a pair of brothers, who knows? And that's fundamentally changed the calculus. Do you see what I mean? Because I could work hard to raise three or four, maybe $5 million. But if somebody comes in with 20, it's really changed this whole, our whole political system for the worse. And I think it's something that we've really got to deal with.
One of the disadvantages of being a U.S. Senator is you can't accept our whopping fee. So, Angus, we know you're in it for the mug.
Yeah.
The Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations mug.
Thank
Angus
you.
King.
Thanks very much. Great to be with you. Thank you.